This is VOA News reporting via remote. I'm Richard Green. North Korea fired two short-range ballistic missiles towards its east coast on Thursday in the direction of Japan. The move followed joint South Korean and U.S. missile drills and the return of a U.S. aircraft carrier to the region in response to the North's recent missile tests. The launch was the sixth in 12 days and the first since North Korea fired an intermediate-range missile over Japan on Tuesday. North Korea's foreign ministry condemned Washington for repositioning the USS Ronald Reagan in the waters off the Korean Peninsula, saying it was a serious threat to the stability of the situation. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Wednesday told his government to take control of Ukraine's embattled Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. But the head of Ukraine's nuclear power company says he will step in and run the facility. VOA's Marissa Melton has more.
Despite Russia's attempts to take over the operations of the Zaporizhia facility, Petro Khotin, head of the Enerhoatom agency, announced Wednesday he will be running the plant from the capital, Kyiv. The plant is currently occupied by Russian troops but operated by Ukrainian staffers. Reporting from Kyiv, Anna Chernikova told VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine Wednesday that Khotin sounded a reassuring note in his remarks. She said he noted that
Ukrainian energy workers continue to keep a nuclear power plant operating in Ukraine according to Ukrainian legislation and making sure that Ukraine and Europe are safe.
Enerhoatom released a statement calling Putin's attempt to take over the plant worthless. Fighting close to the complex has sparked fears of radiation leaks. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
Sydney is set to record its wettest year in 164 years as authorities brace for major floods in Australia's east, with more heavy downpours expected to fall over the next 3 days. This is VOA News. Official data showed Sydney had received rainfall just shy of the record set in 1950. Australia's east coast has been in the grip of a multi-year rain event due to the La Nina weather phenomenon typically associated with increased rainfall that has caused floods in Sydney's suburbs 3 times in the past 2 years and forced tens of thousands to flee their homes. U.S. President Joe Biden has surveyed Hurricane Ian's devastation in Florida and vows the government will help a long rebuilding effort. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
First from Marine One.
You can see a whole hell of a lot of the damage from the air.
And then on the ground in Fort Myers, the president saw ruined homes, debris, a boat that had been flipped into a cafe. Damage, he says, may take years of recovery.
We're not leaving until this gets done. I promise you that.
The president walked alongside a potential 2024 White House foe, Governor Ron DeSantis. Both said they're putting aside political differences for now.
Mr. President, welcome to Florida. We appreciate working together across various levels of government.
Today, we have one job and only one job, and that's to make sure the people of Florida get everything that they need to fully, thoroughly recover.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Thousands of Hungarian students, teachers, and parents blocked a bridge in Budapest near Parliament on Wednesday in support of teachers fighting for higher wages and teachers sacked for protesting. Teachers have launched an I Want to Teach campaign and call for civil disobedience to demand higher wages, a solution to a deepening shortage of teachers, and the right to strike. Protesters carrying banners filled a Budapest bridge, blocking traffic after trade unions had called a nationwide teacher strike for Wednesday. Recapping our top story, North Korea fired two short-range ballistic missiles towards its east coast on Thursday in the direction of Japan. The move followed joint South Korean and U.S. missile drills and the return of a U.S. aircraft carrier to the region in response to the North's recent missile tests. The launch was the sixth in 12 days and the first since North Korea fired an intermediate-range missile over Japan on Tuesday. North Korea's foreign ministry condemned Washington for repositioning the USS Ronald Reagan in the waters off the Korean Peninsula, saying it was a serious threat to the stability of the situation. You can find more on this story and all the stories we're covering on our website, voanews.com. You can also download an app we have. Just search for VOA News. Reporting via remote, I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Thursday, October 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedwafo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russia's president signs final papers to annex four regions of Ukraine as his military struggles to control the new territory.
The decision by Rosatom regarding the establishment of the operating company of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant with its registered office in Moscow is worthless.
Greece warns Turkey and vows to defend its sovereignty against what it calls hostile plans.
Warned Ankara's growing aggression and plans to claim control of areas Greece considers its territory will be stopped.
And at least 25 people killed after a bus carrying a wedding party fell into a 500-meter deep gorge in India. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Russian President Vladimir Putin signed the final papers to annex four regions of Ukraine while his military struggled to control the new territory. The documents finalizing the annexation were published Wednesday on a Russian government website in violation of international laws. The Kremlin also said its Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant will now be operating under the supervision of its agencies. Russian news agency TASS reported that International Atomic Energy Agency Director General Rafael Grossi may soon visit Moscow. Flashpoint Ukraine host Steve Miller speaks with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv as the head of Ukraine's nuclear agency says it will control the facility.
What we know from the Ukrainian side is that Ukrainian's Energoatom announced that the decision by Rosatom regarding the establishment of the operating company of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant with its registered office in Moscow is worthless. This is how they call it. They said that it's a parallel world in where Russian side is living and they will not accept this. And neither Ukrainian side nor international community. This is what they mentioned president of Energoatom regarding this situation. He said that for the moment, acting general director of the Zaporizhzhia power plant would be a new one. And he says that it would be he himself. So Petro Kotin, who is for the moment the president of the Energoatom, he will now be acting general director of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. So Mr. Kotin said that nuclear power plant will continue to work in accordance with Ukrainian legislation in the Ukrainian energy system and within the Energoatom entity.
Turning our attention to the east, Russian commanders say that the front lines around the recently liberated city of Lyman have been stabilized. But what are the Ukrainian authorities saying?
Ukrainian officials have confirmed that the front line in Kharkiv region is basically moving toward the border to Luhansk region. Ukrainian officials call this area as Luhansk front line. And similar analysis we see also in the latest report of the Institute for the Study of War. So Ukrainian forces, after they liberated Lyman, they have preferable positions in this area. And we can see that Ukrainian forces are actually moving toward the Luhansk region front line. We hear confirmations for this past couple of days. We have confirmations from the Ukrainian general staff that a couple of additional settlements were liberated in Donetsk region as well as in Luhansk region. So Ukrainian forces are already on that front line inside these regions. And this despite anything that Russian Federation have said and have decided on paper in terms of annexation.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine's host Steve Miller from Kyiv. Millions of Ukrainian school children are returning to the classroom despite air sirens that are still interrupting lessons. With more than 2,000 school buildings around the country destroyed, educators are working hard to rebuild and bring normality to children's lives. VOA's Eastern Europe chief Miroslav Gongadze visited the village of Bodanivka near Kyiv, where Russian occupiers destroyed the local schools.
Bohdanivka was under Russian occupation for 20 days. Russian forces turned the local school and kindergarten into a base and a hospital. When the Ukrainian army came to liberate the village, the Russians set fire to school facilities, reducing them to ashes. Walking amid the ruins of her life's work, the school director recalls how she ran with her teenage daughter at night across a field and a forest for safety, and how devastated she was when, on her return, she saw what happened to her school. Moscow. Standing in the place that was her office, she speaks of how technologically advanced her school was and how she dreams of bringing her student back here. She's pushing to rebuild the school as soon as possible. More than 300 school children in this village did return to the new school year, and local authorities are trying to accommodate the families and bring normality to the children's life. Alexander Kutsenko, who oversees the local government education system, says that all the children in this village have resumed their education in nearby facilities.
At this time, we are working on rebuilding the education facility. We understand that the country is at war and there is not enough money, so we are hoping for help from investors in terms of rebuilding.
For now, as a temporary solution, this local cultural club is reorganizing to host the school. The civil society initiative Safe Ed Foundation, led by former Minister of Education Hanna Novosad, is helping with this project and others around the country.
Russia is not only having the war against Ukrainian people, it is also having the war against our education system. So if you look at the scale of destruction, it is just enormous. So it is very hard not to notice that they are very deliberately destroying our schools. So more than 2,000 schools around the country are damaged. There are hundreds and hundreds of settlements, cities, villages like this village of Bohdanivka, where there are no school, no kindergartens, no access to education whatsoever, and they do it very explicitly from ideological reasons as well.
Despite the devastation, learning facilities for children are coming back to life.
We are arranging here a so-called digital learning space. So this will be a space for kids who live in this village, where they will have access to devices that are coming within the next week, where they will have access to internet and will be able to either work alone or do their online lessons.
Children and teachers are eager to participate and learn. Even on Sunday, children return to their damaged school and join the effort to bring their community back to life. Мирослава Гонгадзе, VOA News, Богданівка, Ukraine.
Ukraine's top diplomat Dmytro Kuleba began a 10-day tour across Africa this week to, in his words, quote, better explain Ukraine to his counterparts in Africa, unquote, and enlist their support in opposing Russia's aggression. Ousmane Sane is the director of West African Research Center in Dakar, Senegal. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that what Kuleba is hearing from African officials based on his first stop in Senegal is likely not very encouraging.
The name of the country Ukraine came up in this part of the world only because of the Russian invasion. If you didn't have the Russian invasion, you could expect a whole year passing on the African continent without Ukraine being known. Because historically, Africa hasn't had very strong and very close tie with Ukraine, which is not the same thing as Russia. Russia has been here in a most visible way immediately after the Cold War and the two blocs, the United States engaging in political activities for the West and the USSR doing it for people who call themselves communist countries. And in our history, you've had many professional, many senior leaders who got trained in the Soviet Union or in the USSR and even got married there and came back.
Would you say that Russia has more or less controlled the narrative in West Africa and even other parts of Africa?
Yes. Concerning the Eastern countries like Yugoslavia, etc., Albania, Romania, when you said Romani in French, Romania, there was a bell would ring. But for all the other countries who used to be the Soviet Union, well, Russia controlled the story. It was the story of Russia, the old Russian Empire, and the communist countries led by Russia.
In this day and age, you know, it's pretty easy to figure out what's happening on the ground and with the internet and availability to all different kinds of news sources. Why have so many African countries refused to condemn for the invasion of Ukraine?
Why is it that with all the crises blowing up in Africa, there is not much reaction from the other parts of the world? Why is it that with the crisis in Mali, with the crisis in Burkina Faso, and with the jihadists, we have what we had with the French army? Those are also questions to consider. So Africans have got the impression that people want to drag them in this situation. But when it comes to conflicts or crisis situation in Africa, nobody practically budge. This is what I've been hearing many leaders saying, that geographically it's so very far away from us. Politically also it's far away in terms of diplomatic relationship.
That's Ousmane Sane, director of the West African Research Center, speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Dakar, Senegal. Greece is warning it is ready to use all its diplomatic and military might to defend its sovereignty against what it calls hostile plans by its historic foe, Turkey. The direct warning follows a controversial energy deal Turkey recently signed with an element of Libya's divided government. But as Anthi Karasava reports for VOA, the tension that has been building up recently between the two NATO allies is sparking fears of a crisis that could spill out of control and destabilize the military alliance.
Speaking to Greece's parliament, Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis advised Turkey to return, in his words, to a realm of logic. Otherwise, he warned Ankara's growing aggression and plans to claim control of areas Greece considers its territory will be stopped. The Greek leader said geography does not change at the behest of one's decision to change or distort it. He said Greece's borders are its own, and Mitsotakis said they are ready to be defended by its armed forces, as well as by what he said are its powerful diplomatic allies. Lawmakers answered with a roaring applause and standing ovation before Mitsotakis quickly moved to meet with the U.S. ambassador to Greece and a visiting U.S. congressional delegation of the U.S. House of Representatives. Greece and Turkey are longtime foes, but also NATO allies. Relations have cooled and warmed over the decades, often over air and sea rights. Greece's threat comes after Turkey recently signed an agreement with one of Libya's two rival administrations, granting rights to an already controversial energy collaboration in waters that Greece and other countries, including Egypt and Cyprus, also claim. The deal also comes as Greece boosts deployment of troops and U.S. military hardware on two islands closest to Turkey's borders in the Aegean Sea. Actions that recently prompted a complaint from Ankara to Washington. Turkish officials called the deployment a hostile move by a NATO member and warned that Turkey would also mobilize its military in response. Ankara sees the military buildup on the islands of Lesbos and Samos as a violation of a decades-old agreement marking the borders of the two countries. Anthi Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
Thank you, Anthi. Ethiopia's federal government says it has accepted an invitation from the African Union to take part in the peace talks aimed at ending the ongoing civil war and halting hostilities against the country's Tigray region leadership. Fred Hartal reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
African Union Chief Moussa Faki Mahamat extended the invite to peace talks in South Africa in a letter addressed to the leaders of the Tigray region and the Ethiopian federal government. Redwan Hussein, the National Security Advisor to Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, confirmed Wednesday morning that the federal government has accepted the invitation. The decision is in line with our principal position regarding the peaceful resolution of the conflicts and the need to have talks without preconditions, Redwan said. Separately, a federal government statement reaffirmed Addis Ababa's preference for peace talks mediated by the African Union. The Tigray region's ruling party and its forces currently fighting the federal government are yet to respond to the invitation. However, last month, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, released a statement saying it was ready to abide by an immediate cessation of hostilities and participate in an AU-led peace process. Fighting in Ethiopia's civil war renewed in late August, breaking a fragile truce that had been in place since March and halting much-needed aid deliveries to the Tigray region, where more than 5 million people need humanitarian assistance. According to the letter sent by Faki, mediation efforts by the AU's envoy for the Horn of Africa will be supported by former Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and the former Deputy President of South Africa, Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka. The letter says the talks are aimed at laying the foundation for a structured and sustained mediation between the two sides towards a durable resolution of the conflict. According to a diplomatic source in Addis Ababa, This AU core mediation team will be supported by observers from the United States, the European Union, the United Nations, and the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, an aid country trade bloc in the region. The talks in South Africa represent the highest level effort to date to end the nearly two-year war and follow at least three rounds of discussions between senior officials on both warring sides. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
In other news, at least 25 people were killed after a bus carrying a wedding party fell into a 500-meter deep gorge in India's northern Pauri town of Uttarakhand, said police on Wednesday. Uttarakhand Chief Minister Panksha Singh Dami visited the accident site on Wednesday and interacted with relief workers as he took stock of the situation. He also met with the injured in hospitals. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. The World Trade Organization predicts global trade growth will slow sharply to 1% in 2023, down from the expected high of 3.5% this year. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva on the WTO's revised trade forecast.
WTO economists say trade has played a key role in keeping the global economy running throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. While merchandise trade plunged amid lockdowns in 2020, they note it subsequently rebounded, keeping the world supplied with food, medicine, and other essential goods. However, they say multi-pronged crises, including the pandemic, climate shocks, and the war in Ukraine, continue to cause supply chain disruptions. Fiscal and monetary policies and inflationary pressures, they note, are causing energy and commodity prices to rise. They say low-income developing countries in particular face serious risks from insecurity and debt distress. WTO Director General Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala says most regions will likely register slightly positive export growth in 2023, with the exceptions of Africa and the Middle East. Both regions, she says, will experience negative export growth. She says world GDP next year is expected to slow to 2.3%, down nearly a full percentage point from the WTO's previous estimate.
Policymakers face unenviable choices as they attempt to find an optimal balance among fighting inflation, maintaining employment, and advancing important policy goals such as the transition to cleaner energy. Trade restrictions may be a tempting response to economic distress, but these would only deepen inflationary pressures and reduce living standards.
Okonjo-Iweala says free trade generates growth and can help keep prices from rising. For example, keeping markets open for food trade, she says, will increase the availability of essential foodstuffs and maintain downward pressure on prices.
Our monitoring work on food trade has pointed to some recent backsliding on restrictions, so we need to remain vigilant. Looking ahead, a better response to the supply chain vulnerabilities exposed by the past 2 years is to build a more diversified, less concentrated base for producing goods and services.
She says diversification will boost economic growth and contribute to supply resilience and long-term price stability. She says it also can help meet current and future economic challenges. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Australian authorities are preparing to repatriate more than 60 Australian widows and children of Islamic State fighters from detention camps in Syria. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Australian officials insist the detainees will be put under surveillance when they're repatriated and that the women have agreed to be subject to control orders. More than 20 Australian women and some 40 children are being held at the Al Haul and Rojh detention camps in northeastern Syria. They are the widows, sons and daughters of dead or imprisoned Islamic State militants. Australian officials have said it was unlikely all would be brought out at once and that several rescue missions could be needed. Many of the women have insisted they were tricked or pressured by their husbands into travelling to Syria. But in Australia, opposition lawmakers believe the repatriation of individuals who could have been radicalised poses an unnecessary risk. There are also concerns about the financial costs of supervision and surveillance by the police and the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, known as ASIO. Opposition leader Peter Dutton told reporters in Canberra Tuesday that the Australian government must provide specific details of the rescue plan.
We need to understand how it is, with limited resources, ASIO and the Australian Federal Police can provide the guarantees to keep the Australian public safe. The Prime Minister needs to provide the detail and provide the assurance to the Australian public.
In 2019, Australia undertook a clandestine mission to rescue 8 Australian orphans, including a pregnant teenager, from the camps. But since then, the Canberra government has refused further repatriations because of security concerns. But officials now believe it's safe to consider rescuing the women and their children. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com, and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chinedofa in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Of the many atrocities committed during Putin's full-scale war against Ukraine, some of the most grievous relate to Russia's filtration operations. Filtration is the anodyne word describing a massive operation the Kremlin has launched to intimidate, imprison, forcibly deport, or disappear those Ukrainian citizens that Moscow decides could be a threat to its imperial ambitions to control and then annex Ukraine's territory. A recent report by the Yale Humanitarian Research Lab identified 21 filtration-related facilities in the Donetsk Oblast alone. The report identified 4 types of facilities: those used for registration, holding, interrogation, and long-term detention. There are also checkpoints along main thoroughfares where Ukrainian civilians fleeing from Russia-controlled areas are subjected to filtration, and cases where civilians are simply rounded up and forcibly taken to filtration facilities. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield noted, "Estimates from a variety of sources, including the Russian government, indicate that Russian authorities have interrogated, detained, forcibly deported between 900,000 and 1.6 million Ukrainian citizens from their homes to Russia, often to isolated regions in the Far East." She also said, "Estimates are that thousands of children have been subject to filtration, some separated from their families and taken from orphanages before being put up for adoption in Russia." Why is this filtration being done, along with other measures the Kremlin is taking in the areas of Ukraine currently held by Russia's forces? The imposition of Russia's educational curriculum in schools? Attempts to get Ukrainian citizens to apply for Russian Federation passports? "The reason is simple," said Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield, "to prepare for an attempted annexation. This effort to fabricate these facts on the ground is the predicate to sham referenda. It is part of the Russian playbook for Ukraine that we've been warning council members about since the beginning of the war." As the State Department has noted, the unlawful transfer and deportation of protected persons is a grave breach of the 4th Geneva Convention on the Protection of Civilians and constitutes a war crime. State Department Principal Deputy Spokesperson Vidant Patel said, "We demand Russia halt its filtration operations immediately. We call on the global community to join us in condemning this practice and calling for humanitarian access to be granted."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.